Hallo, so schön, dass du da bist hier beim Podcast Happy, Holy and Confident, dein Podcast fürs Herz und den Verstand. Mein Name ist Laura Marlina Seiler und diese Folge heute ist eine der Folgen, warum ich vor 7 Jahren mit diesem Podcast angefangen habe, ohne es vielleicht so genau zu wissen, dass das tatsächlich einer der Gründe ist. Denn als ich vor 7 Jahren mit dem Podcast angefangen habe, habe ich meine absoluten Top-10-Interviewgäste in eins meiner Notizbücher geschrieben. Und eine von diesen Gästinnen ist Jane Goodall. Und Jane Goodall ist mein, ich weiß gar nicht, wie ich es beschreiben soll, diese Frau, seit ich ein Kind bin, berührt mich diese Frau so sehr, ihre Arbeit, ihr Tun, ihr ganzes Sein. Und ich bin, wenn ich von jemandem ein Fan bin, dann von Jane Goodall. Und es hat sich tatsächlich ergeben durch die wundervolle Michi Schreiber, die ja auch ihr Buch bei mir im Malia Verlag verlegt hat und die selber ja eine ganz, ganz tolle Aktivistin ist für Tierschutz. Also Michi Schreiber, schaut bei ihr alle gerne auch nochmal vorbei. Und durch Michi, die Jane Goodall in Oxford getroffen hat, hat es sich dann tatsächlich ergeben, dass ich einen Kontakt zu ihr aufbauen konnte und sie jetzt bei mir im Podcast zu Gast ist. Und ich war noch nie so aufgeregt vor irgendeinem Podcast-Interview. Du wirst merken, dass mein Englisch komplett weg war. Also ich war so aufgeregt und es war ein so wunderschönes Gespräch. Ich weiß gar nicht, wie oft ich geweint habe in diesem Interview. Vorher, nachher, ich war völlig fertig nach diesem Gespräch. Saß eine Stunde einfach auf meinem Stuhl und habe geweint, weil es mich so sehr berührt hat und es irgendwie so eine riesige Bedeutung für mich hatte, mit Jane Goodall reden zu dürfen, reden zu können. Und hier ist das Gespräch. Eine Stunde mit Jane Goodall. Jane Goodall, ihr werdet sie alle kennen. Sie ist eine der größten Tierschutzaktivistinnen unserer Zeit. Sie hat unglaubliche Arbeit geleistet für wissenschaftliche Erkenntnisse über Schimpansen, über Affen und hat ganz, ganz lange wirklich auch im Urwald zusammen mit den Affen nicht gelebt, in Anführungsstrichen, aber sie eben dort beobachtet und das erzählt sie alles auch im Interview. Und bis heute ist sie noch aktivistisch tätig. Sie hat mittlerweile ganz viele Schulen gegründet, sie hat ganz viele Organisationen gegründet, womit sie Kinder zum Beispiel unterstützt, selber in den Aktivismus zu kommen. Und sie hat das Jane Goodall Institute, was natürlich auch dazu beiträgt, dass mehr Schimpansen gerettet werden und wo es Auffangstationen gibt für Schimpansenbabys, die zum Beispiel Waisen Schimpansenbabys sind, weil ihre Mamas umgebracht worden sind. Und ihre Arbeit ist einfach unglaublich. Und nicht nur das, sondern was vor allen Dingen, was mich so sehr bei ihr berührt, ist, dass sie das Ganze mit einem solchen inneren Frieden macht und mit einer solchen inneren Ruhe all diesen Ungerechtigkeiten auf der Welt begegnet. Und das wahrscheinlich tatsächlich der einzige Ansatz ist, wie wir wirklich etwas verändern können, nämlich mit diesem Vertrauen, dass sich die Welt verändern kann und dass jeder von uns dazu aufgerufen ist, seinen Beitrag zu leisten. Ja, also dieses Gespräch ist, für mich war es lebensverändernd und ich hoffe, es ist für dich auch. Ich wünsche dir unglaublich viel Freude mit dieser Folge. Wie immer, komm natürlich so gerne danach bei mir bei Instagram vorbei, @LauraMarlinaSeiler. Teil mir deine Gedanken zu der Folge. Und du findest in den Shownotes auch alle Links zu der Arbeit von Jane Goodall. Sie hat auch ein wundervolles Buch über Hoffnung geschrieben, werde ich dir auch verlinken. Also tauch ein in ihre Arbeit, weil diese Frau wirklich so eine wahnsinnige Inspiration ist. Und das alles gesagt, viel Spaß mit dem Gespräch, mit dem Interview mit Jane Goodall. So I'm really so excited and honored to have you in the podcast. Jane Goodall, welcome, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me, because I know that this show is very popular thanks to you.
Well, for me, really, when I started about like doing the record with you, I remembered writing in one of my journals about 7 years ago when I started the podcast. I wrote that one of my biggest dreams to interview in the podcast is Jane Goodall. this is really like something magical coming together today for me. So thank you so much for being here.
Good.
I would like to start in the past to in your childhood, because I think it's really inspiring that you as a very young girl already knew that you want to go to Africa in a time where I mean, traveling has been very different back then, but not only traveling, also the knowledge about yourself as a young girl to be even allowed to do something like that. I mean, it was such a big dream. So how did it happen that you, as such a young girl, already knew kind of inside of yourself that this is maybe the path you want to go in your life?
Well, first of all, I was literally born loving animals. I mean, you know, I just popped out of my mother loving animals and wanting to be out there and interested in this little photo, you know, black and white photos of me looking down at some worms. And you know, my mother came, she tells me I was 1 and a half, and she came up to say goodnight, and I got all these earthworms in my bed. So, you know, instead of saying, oh, how dare you, you know, throw them out, she just said, Jane, I think they'll be happier in the earth. They might die here. We took them back into the garden. So I had this amazing, supportive mother, and I owe so much to her. So that when I was 10, I read Tarzan of the Apes. I'd saved up my money. You know, it was just, the war was still raging. I had very little pocket money. And I saved up my few pennies, and I could find this little tiny book, Tarzan of the Apes. And I took it home. I took it up my favorite tree. And by the way, I'm talking to you from the house where I grew up.
Wow.
In Bournemouth.
It's the same house.
Same home.
Wow.
And so my favorite tree's over there. I took Tarzan up there and read him and fell passionately in love with this glorious lord of the jungle. And that was when, you know, I will grow up, I will live with wild animals, and I will write books about them. And having this supportive mother, she'd already, you know, after the war, this shows you how wise she was. She let me go off to teach English to a German family because she told me, I want you to understand that, yes, we hated Germans for a while, but I want you to know that Nazis and Hitler, it's very different from the German people. And I want you to understand that. So see how wise she was.
Wow.
Yes.
What was her background? What made her such an amazing, inspiring woman? Like, did she grow up herself in a household like that? Or was it just her nature?
No, her father was a congregational minister. Her mother was one of these very, very early pioneers in that she got a job when women weren't getting jobs, before she got married, that is. And so Mum had two sisters and a brother and grew up in a family like that. And her elder brother went off and studied medicine. And her elder sister went and became a physiotherapist.
Oh.
And she was looking after us, which you did in those days. So we were in France when the war broke out. She brought us back here. The house was my grandmother's, and we lived in it with all those people, Mum's sisters, and not the brother, but, you know, and my little sister. So me and my sister now own the house.
Wow, that's so beautiful. I mean, I think this is also for everyone listening. I think how important it is as parents to really encourage what the children have already in their hearts.
It's really important.
Yeah.
And I meet so many people who say, well, my parents pushed me to do this. My parents pushed me to do that. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And I haven't really been happy. It's very sad.
Yes. Yes. So when was the moment, or do you remember the day when you had the ticket to fly to Tanzania, I guess it was, right? The first country you flew to? What was the first country you went to?
We didn't have money for university, so I had a job in London. I did a secretarial course, very boring. And I had a job in London, which was actually a wonderful job. But anyway, a letter from a school friend whose parents had moved to Kenya.
Yeah, Kenya was
it. That was it. That was the opportunity. And so I gave in my notice, and I had to have money for the ticket. No planes back then. Planes, there were some, but they were very expensive. So I was going by boat. And I earned the money going to a hotel just around the corner over there, working as a waitress, and finally got enough money. And the boat should have gone through the Suez Canal, but Britain was by then having a silly short war with Egypt. I don't know what it was about. So Suez was closed. We had to go all the way around Cape Town.
Wow. And
so it took about nearly a month, and it was so amazing. I mean, you know, the sea gradually got bluer, and I remember my first flying fish. And the first place I put foot on African soil was Cape Town, which, have you been there?
Yeah, I went there 6 times already. Yes.
So the beautiful Table Mountain. Mm. And Mum had some friends there. While the boat stopped for 2 days, they took care of me. And I was so excited. I'm in Africa. But then on the back of every seat and doors to the hotels were these words in Afrikaans, Sligs Blank. What do they mean? White people only.
Yeah.
I wasn't brought up that way. I wasn't brought up to judge people by the color of their skin. So I couldn't wait to leave. And getting to Kenya was much better because they were on the verge of independence from Britain.
Mm.
And it was a great feeling of, you know, coming freedom. And I heard about Louis Leakey and went to see him at the Natural History Museum. I think he was impressed. I knew so much about animals, even though, you know, I hadn't been to college. And so he basically gave me a job. He just lost his secretary. So how about that? Horrible secretarial course, boring. But there I was, ready to go into this world where everybody could answer all my questions about mammals and birds and insects. And, you know, it was just magical.
That's so beautiful.
And he's the one who offered me the chance of studying chimps in Tanzania.
And how was the moment you first saw a chimpanzee in real life? Like, how was that feeling for you? Do you still remember which one it was and how you felt?
I remember it very well. It was a chimpanzee running away. For 4 months, they all ran away. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't run necessarily, but they vanished into the forest. Fortunately, one of them, whom I named David Greybeard, he's up here behind me, he began to lose his fear.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that I saw fishing for termites at a time when it was thought that only humans used and made tools. So this was amazing because I had money. Leakey had somehow found money for 6 months. I mean, for this crazy idea, a young woman going out into the jungle, finally he got money for 6 months. And then the British authorities, because Tanzania back then was Tanganyika, you know, it was the old East German Africa, and it was a protectorate. And the British authorities said, no, we won't take responsibility. This is a ridiculous idea. But in the end, they said, oh, she must come with a companion, not alone. So who volunteered? That same amazing mother.
Mm.
So she came for 4 of the 6 months, and it was amazing what she did for the whole program.
Wow. Just like when I think about it, how beautiful also for you and your mother to have this experience together. I mean, I think that's a very special, unique experience as well to share this with your own mother. It's really beautiful.
She didn't come up in the mountains. She stayed in the camp. And we'd been made to take a cook. You know, for prestige, you must take a cook. And he was a wonderful cook. And he'd been employed by all the British in the nearby Kigoma. But they all fired him because he just had a love of alcohol. He was always pinching alcohol. So they said, perfect for Jane and her mother. There won't be any alcohol in their camp. And he's a wonderful cook. It took 2 weeks and he found a really potent brew made of fermented bananas. Half the time he was, tiddly. So Mum was left down with a tiddly cook. Baboons who began raiding the tent because they're very opportunistic. Buffalo wandering by. And I'd go up before light and come back at dusk. So she was alone all day. But she started a clinic. She wasn't a doctor or a nurse, but her brother, as I've said, was a doctor. Her sister was a physio. So she had some very simple, you know, aspirins and band-aids and bandages and old-fashioned remedies. And the fishermen began coming along the beach from further and further. I found afterwards she was known as a white witch doctor.
Wow.
So from the start, she began to help me to start really good relations with the local people, which was fantastic.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
How was it for you? How old were you back then when you first went there?
I was 23 when I first went to Africa and met Leakey. Then I had to wait while he found the money and got permission. And then I went back and I was 26 by then. But in those days, 23, 26 were very young and naive, not like today, you know, when young people go off traveling and all the rest. That didn't happen back then.
How was it for you? I just imagine being alone with 24 years old, 23, 24, walking through the jungle, like by yourself in a, like, would you say that, or differently asked, like, what is it inside of yourself that gives you this trust and this knowledge and to like move also through an habitat that is not your like natural habitat you grew in? I mean, you grew up very differently. So I just imagine how was it for you? Or what was it inside of yourself, your inner voice, that were you just calm, or were you curious? Have you been afraid sometimes? I mean, because it's the jungle. it's not like, going to London.
No, but remember, I dreamed about it since I was 10.
Yeah.
So I was living a dream, and I always had this conviction that animals won't hurt you if you don't startle them, make them afraid.
Mm.
And people say, well, that was stupid because there were leopards and there were buffalo. I said, well, you say it's stupid, but they didn't hurt me. So why was it stupid? And of course, animals will also attack if they've been harmed by people, but they were completely wild back then. So was I sometimes frightened? Yes. Occasionally, I definitely was. First time when the chimps began to get used to me, they treated me as though I was a predator and screamed at me and waved branches, and one of them hit me on the head. And, well, it was a bit scary. They weren't trying to hurt me. They just wanted me to go away. And when I didn't go away, and, you know, I always pretended to ignore them when they were like that, just dug holes in the ground, you know, look, come on, I'm not hurting you. I'm just digging around in the ground. And they got used to me, and then they came to trust me. So it was a slow, but very, you know, it was okay.
What gave you the knowledge to know in the moments, for example, when they were trying to protect themselves and because they thought you were a predator? What gave you the knowledge to dug a hole and to just be like, no, I'm just here doing my thing? Was it just like your intuition that did guide you?
Well, nothing else.
Wow.
Because nobody had done it. Nobody had even tried to study chimps in the wild.
Wow.
There was no book to go by, you know, but this conviction that animals won't hurt you. And it sort of came naturally to do something that shows you're not aggressive. And so by not running from them or waving branches at them, or, you know, I might have been killed.
When was the first moment? Which was the chimp you knew, or that he or she trust you? What was the moment where you could feel now something is changing? And how long did it take until the moment that they were like, okay, Jane is okay. She can stay.
Well, again, it was David. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it was about a year from the beginning. And he was allowing me to follow him. Sometimes chimps go about alone. And I thought I'd lost him because he went through a great tangle of vegetation. Never mind, I'll find him another day. But when I finally crawled through, there he was sitting, and he was looking back. I mean, honestly, looked as though he was waiting for me. Maybe he was, I don't know. And lying on the ground was a ripe red palm nut, which chimps love. So I sat near him and I held my hand out towards him, and he turned his head away. So I pushed my hand a little bit closer, and he turned back. He looked directly into my eyes. He reached out. He took the nut. He dropped it with almost the same movement, and then very gently squeezed my fingers, which is how chimps reassure each other. Wow. And it was the most magic moment. And then he just lay down on the ground and went to sleep. So wow. He helped the other chimps to lose their fear. Because if he was in a group that was ready to run and he was there, he would just sit calmly. And I suppose the others thought, well, she can't be so frightening after all. Because they trusted David. He was a kind of leader. Not the top male, but the other chimps liked him. The young ones would run to him for reassurance. He was gentle and wise.
Wow, that is so beautiful. What did you feel in that moment? Could you even grasp like the magnitude of?
I could, because it was, you know, we were obviously communicating in a way that was probably in our common ancestor 6 million years ago. And so, you know, from what he did, I understood how he was feeling. He didn't want the nut, but I understood that he understood my motive was good. And so we had this mutual understanding based on a way of communicating, probably in humans before we had words.
I believe that one of the biggest misunderstandings we humans have is that we think that we are some kind of superior to animals or to nature, or that we are not nature, not part of nature. What I think, I mean, it's so stupid to think that. What did you learn from the chimps? What was it that they gave you as a human being? What you learned from them that you maybe never learned from humans so far?
Well, the main thing I learned was how like us they are in so many, many ways. You know, we didn't then, but we now know that we share 98.6% of DNA. So it's almost the same. Of course, the behaviors diverge, but nevertheless, kissing, embracing, holding hands, swaggering, shaking the fist. I mean, two male chimpanzees competing for dominance remind me of some human male politicians.
Yeah. There might be the one or the other.
Except it's a bit insulting to the chimps.
But, yeah, true. Good point. You know,
the way the mothers treat their offspring, the long-lasting family bonds, the children continue associating with mum throughout her life, really. They gradually spend more time away. They show grief, and that one infant died when his mother died. He just couldn't cope without her. They can be altruistic. And when I'd been with them about 2 years, Leakey said, now you have to get a degree because I want other scientists to take you seriously. Mm. So when I got to Cambridge University, I was the eighth person in their long, long history to get into a PhD program without an undergraduate degree. And I was told that I'd done everything wrong. Chimps, your subjects, they shouldn't be named. They should be numbered. And you can't talk about their personalities, their minds, or their emotions because those are unique to humans. Well, I'd had this amazing teacher when I was a child who had taught me this wasn't true. That was my dog. Anybody who's had an animal of any kind and had a good relationship knows we are not the only species. with personalities, minds, and emotions. And if I'd given them numbers, I could never have remembered who was who, you know. So I didn't confront the professors. I just quietly went on writing about the chimps as they were, calling them by name. And so then the Geographic sent Hugo van Lawick out to take film. And when his films began going around, you know, the scientists gradually realized that they were wrong. Wow. And, you know, I swear that I don't think any of them believed that animals didn't have personality, mind, or emotion, but they hadn't worked out how to study it. Mm. And they were trying to change observational field work into a hard science, and it can never, ever be a hard science, like chemistry or something.
Would you say that they were maybe also afraid of you as a woman bringing a very different approach to scientific research, and maybe being truthful, or not even maybe, but being truthful about what you experienced, because you were there, you really studied it. Would you say that they were also afraid of you and your knowledge and what you brought? No?
I don't think so. I just think that the scientists in animal behavior back then, you know, they didn't want to be challenged. I think it would have been the same if I'd been male. Mm-hmm. They might have been ruder to me if I was a man, actually.
Oh,
but
wow.
They were impressed, actually, by this young girl going out in the forest. And I luckily had one, the most incredible supervisor. And he helped me. Having been my sternest critic, he came to Gombe for 2 weeks. And he helped me put my, you know, very rebellious thinking in terms that were acceptable to other scientists. Mm. So I had an amazing time all told at Cambridge.
Wow.
Yeah.
One thing that I find really inspiring in your path and how you approach what you do is you didn't had a bachelor's degree, or you didn't go to university first before you gave yourself the permission to go and study the chimps. And also in my experience I have so far, because I did a lot of things in my life. I just did them. I didn't wait for anyone to give me the approval or to first get this or that degree to be able to do what I do today. So for everyone listening right now who's thinking, oh, should I maybe first learn this or do this? What can give ourselves the trust or the belief in ourselves to pursue our way without waiting for anyone to give us the certificate that proves that we are ready?
Well, I was lucky. I had my mother.
Mm.
She built up confidence. And unfortunately, some people don't have supportive parents. So many, many young people have looked to me as an example. And so many have said, Jane, I want to thank you because you proved that because you did it, I can do it too.
Yes, that's so true.
Yeah.
When I listened to your story, I had the feeling, or I have the feeling, that kind of the universe was watching over you or something, like something was just like giving the blessing to you and be like, okay, Jane, wherever you walk, we will open the door for you because we feel that it comes from a very true place inside of your soul. Do you have the same feeling? Like, would you say, looking back, that many doors were open to you by...
Yeah, I think so. I really think so. And I think when I look back over my long life, when I'm nearly 90, it's wow. Weird that I am. And I look back and there were points where I had to make choices. And, you know, the first one was going to Africa, and it came just at the right time. And, you know, the next one, well, I suppose the next choice was to get married and have a child, married the photographer, of course. And then the tough one, or it should have been tough, was the moment when I knew I had to leave what I loved and start going around and talking to people about the state of the environment and who animals truly are and to help young people who were losing hope. But that, again, it wasn't a choice. I just went to this four-day conference that I helped organize, and all the CHIMP people came together for the first time from the, by then, six different study sites. And we had one session on conservation, shocking, across Africa, and one on conditions in captivity. Chimps in 5-foot by 5-foot medical research labs. They're just because they're so like us, with researchers looking at the physical similarities, refusing to look at these, you know, the psychiatric, the psychological and behavioral similarities. So I went to the conference planning to go on studying at Gombe, writing papers for the rest of my life, really, but I left as an activist. So it wasn't a decision. I always think it was like, you know, the story of St. Paul on the road to Damascus. He left as the most stern persecutor of the early Christians, and he left as their apostle. It's strange. Mm. Like that, it just, I didn't think about it. I had to do something. I didn't know what to do, but I had to do it.
Do you, when you have moments like this where you have to make really big life decisions, do you meditate on it? Or is there anything you do to connect to your intuition, to that inner voice? Or is it just very clear, very loud, and speaks to you and you just follow it?
Yeah, I just follow it. Mm. I don't think about it. I just do it.
Wow. How do you know, how do you differentiate your head and maybe the ego from the heart and the voice that tells you what to do? How do you know it's coming from that place? Is it the feeling that comes along with it?
I don't know. I mean, I've never thought about it. I've just, you know, it just happens and I do it. I don't particularly think about it. The only problem I had where I really had to think and think and think was when I divorced my husband. Mm. But, you know, we were just, we were bickering all the time, and I didn't think that was good for our son. And B, he couldn't be at Gombe anymore, so I couldn't be with him and he couldn't be with me. And it just wasn't working. Mm. But it was a tough decision all the same.
Yes.
I wish it had worked out, but
I
apart from that, everything else has just fallen into place. And leaving Gombe, starting our program to improve the lives of the local people who are cutting down the trees simply to survive, to grow more food or to make money from charcoal. And finding young people losing hope and starting our Roots and Shoots program. You know, those things just happened when they were meant to happen.
Did you ever meet David, how did you call him, the silver beard?
David Greybeard.
Greybeard. Did you meet him again?
Oh, well, I mean, I was at Gombe until 1986. So from 60 to 86, I was there on and off all the time. And I met David almost every day when we were feeding bananas.
You grow closer, like the relationship, the more time you spent with him? Would you say that the relationship between you two changed?
I would say the trust grew. I mean, I was allowed to groom him. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty amazing to groom a wild chimpanzee. And of course, these days we wouldn't do it. We don't want to give them disease. But in those days, there was the very few people out in the field had feeding stations. Like anthropologists going out and giving beads to the natives like they used to do. So the chimps came to camp and I knew them like family. The personality is so different. And I still, you know, the recent film called Jane, made by the Geographic from old footage, was so nostalgic. Those chimpanzees that I knew so well.
I can imagine. Are you planning to go back in this year? Do you still go into the jungle, or is it for you now
I go back to Gombe twice a year. The research is still going. I need to talk with the researchers and, you know, give them a boost. I don't follow the chimps high up in the hills anymore. It wouldn't be sensible. I could slip. I could break a hip. I would be a terrific nuisance to everybody. But I do go into the forest on my own. And that, I think, is a couple, I go twice a year, but only for about 4 days. Then I have to visit the villagers and look, see how our programs are going, talk to the young girls who got scholarships so they can have secondary education, and visit all the, I mean, you know, there are 27 Jane Goodall Institutes now around the world. There's Roots and Shoots, our youth program for all ages. That's now in 67 countries with active groups, all choosing projects to help people, to help animals, to help the environment.
It's amazing.
It's Germany, it's growing fast.
It's amazing. Yeah, I will also, for everyone listening, I will put all the links to your organizations in the show notes so everyone can look them up, be part of it, donate and support your work. I will, there will be everything in there so people can support and be part of it.
And you can tell them I will be very, very grateful. That's always the problem, getting money for all our incredible programs. You know, we have sanctuaries for orphan chimps whose mothers have been shot. We run two of those. One is the biggest in Africa. It's got nearly 200 chimps.
This brings me to an important question, because for you, the chimps, I mean, they are like family to you. You are so connected to animals in general and the human species. I mean, how we treat animals, not only the chimps, but animals in general. I mean, you're vegan as well. So if we just look at the food, the meat production and everything that is happening there, how, and I mean, you speak about it in your beautiful book, The Book of Hope, about it as well, but how don't you freak out?
Well, I do, but, you know, the important thing is you've got to change minds. The only way you can do that, it's not by shouting and screaming and pointing fingers and weeping. It's by telling stories. So all your listeners can Google something called, not Picasso the artist, but Pigcasso. And I'll bet you when they watch Pigcasso, they won't want to eat pork or bacon anymore. And so if you can get people to feel in there, it's again the head and the heart. So don't try and tackle the head, because people will have arguments to disprove you all the time.
Yeah.
If you can reach the heart, because change has to come from within.
Yes,
I think.
Still, in moments, I just guess probably you also have moments where you see something, or I mean, especially in the orphanage you have for the chimp babies, where you say there are so many babies, which means so many mothers have been shot.
Yeah.
Just also for me, really personal, because sometimes I really struggle with that. I sometimes lie in my bed and it breaks my heart, really. So what do you do for yourself to just keep that hope and don't let it like break your heart inside, but to just keep the way and still believe in humanity and that we can turn it around somehow?
Well, I mean, first of all, I do get upset. I cry. I get angry. I get furious, but I channel that into what can I do to make a difference. And, you know, even little things like veganism is getting more and more and more common. And I was a vegetarian, but then when I learned about what they do to the dairy cows and the chickens who lay eggs, you know, that's, I can't. And the first time when I gave up eating meat, it was in the late 60s, I think. And I read Peter Singer's book called Animal Liberation, and I hadn't heard about factory farms at that time. And I looked at, I think I was on a plane, And I looked at this piece of chicken on my plate and I thought, this is symbolic of fear, pain, death.
Yeah.
Not for me. Again, it was something that just like that. It wasn't a decision. It was like everything else. It just happened.
When you say you channel the sadness and the anger, is it also kind of a decision you do? You feel it and then you channel it into, okay, what can I do? Is it really like just this very conscious decision you do?
Well, you know, I think I was born with this. You know, the way I go about things is by trying to change people from inside. So it isn't sort of a conscious, oh, I must do this, oh, I must do that. It's like, you know, when I left that conference, I didn't know what to do. So one of the first things I did, which was awful, I don't know why they let me, but I went into one of these chimp labs. And I'll never forget meeting this beautiful male. He was a bit like David Greybeard. And I was in a mask and a gown. And he was in this 5-foot by 5-foot cage. And I went down on my elbow. And I started to cry because I was thinking of the chimps in Gombe with their leafy nests. And he had concrete floor. And I was quite close to the cage. He couldn't get his hand through. He reached out a finger and he wiped away the tears.
Oh, God.
Yes. And that was when I made a vow, I will somehow get you out. So unlike all the animal rights people who just write violent, abusive letters, I managed to get together a group of people from the lab. And actually, it was when I very first came out from going around, and I was sat at a table, and all these men were sitting around, all men. And I realized they were the top people from the National Institutes of Health who ran this particular lab. And I saw they were all looking at me. Well, I'm supposed to say something. I'm just in shock, you know. So what I said, it just came from me. I said, well, I'm sure you're all caring and compassionate like I am. So you must feel the same as I do about what's happening in there. So what I did, I sent them film of the chimps and books about the wild chimps. And it's taken a long time, but we first of all got better conditions. They all had bedding and they had things to do. And I got a young man who went into one lab and a woman who went into another, and they enriched their lives and, you know, gave them stuff to do because they get so bored, and they got slightly bigger cages, but it was still the fight to get them out. And that happened about 6 years ago, so it was a long time.
Wow.
But we were making improvements all the time.
Wow. Now, and how did you where did they went from there?
Sanctuaries. They're in several different sanctuaries where they got big open spaces and bedding and lots of caring people, and they're pretty amazing.
Wow.
And then Africa, what am I going to do about Africa? Money, little bit, managed to get to 6 study sites, learned a lot about the problems faced by the chimps, but that's when I began realizing the forests are being destroyed, yes, partly by loggers coming in from other countries, but also all around Gombe because the people were so poor.
Yeah.
You know, they run out of land, their own farmland in these villages was overused and infertile. And we started this program called Take Care or Tukari. And it's just, we've now got people in 104 villages throughout Chimp Range in Tanzania who understand protecting the forest isn't just for wildlife, it's for their own future. And so they become our partners in conservation. So, and that's in 6 other African countries now. And we got people working on the bushmeat trade, helping to get stricter law enforcement, working with the government. But again, not pointing fingers at anybody. And a lot of these poachers, if they get a job, they'll stop poaching. And a lot of poachers in Africa are now rangers protecting the animals.
Wow.
Yeah, because they've got money.
Yeah. It's probably, it is probably the solution to just give other opportunities how the people can earn money and make their living instead of killing the animals, but also seeing,
it's all the difference.
When, for me, for example, I'm like you, like since I'm a young girl, like I had so many animals as a child, and I grew up like with sheep and chickens and a horse and dogs. And I was talking more to animals than to human beings. Like I also thought always that I can talk to animals. Like for me, it was very strange that people couldn't kind of. And now for me, I still have, and I do a lot of work for animals. I donate like a lot of money to just support projects and everything, but I still sometimes I feel so frustrated, or I feel like if you are not like if not your entire life is about being an activist or protecting animals, for example, but being also in a, let's say, normal job or a day-to-day job, how, like, what would you say for people in a position like this? How can we change the world, or how can we support in a way that it's sustainable and helpful, and what can we do as normal people kind of to really support your work, or in general the work of people who are activists and who are really trying to change the world?
Well, I, you know, different people can help in different ways. Some help with giving money, and, you know, helping the planet as a whole, becoming vegetarian or preferably vegan, or at least eating less meat, you know, even that makes a difference. And the vegetarian options are so good now, you can't tell the difference. I mean, it's amazing. At first it was awful, but now it's really good. So, you know, some people can spend time volunteering in a dog or cat shelter, for example, learn more about what there is, and follow your heart. Do what you feel best at. You know, just think about it. Like we tell our Roots and Shoots kids, every single day you live on the planet, you make an impact of some sort. And so think about the choices you make, the little ones. What do you buy? Where did it come from? Did it harm the environment? Was it cruel to animals? Is it cheap because of unfair wages in other parts of the country? And if so, try not to buy it. And sometimes people in poverty, they can't afford to do that. They just have to buy the cheapest. So that's, you know, another reason for eliminating poverty. So different people do different things. But if we think about what we do, if we think about the kind of environmental footprint we leave on the planet, you know, just if it was just me doing something, it wouldn't matter two hoots. But if you get hundreds, thousands, millions, hopefully billions of people all thinking about how they live, but we've got a long way to go before we get to the billions. Because, you know, people living in poverty, as I say, they can't make those choices. They have no option. People in countries torn apart by war, you know, there's so much to put right in this poor old world. And each of us must do what we can and not try and solve the whole problem. You can't solve the whole problem.
Is this also one way to not lose hope, to really focus on a particular way you go and be okay with that? Because this is sometimes I sometimes feel so like, okay, I want to do this and I want to change this and I want to change this, and then I don't know what to do, and this is sometimes so frustrating, and then of course I lose energy. So you would say it's good focus on this one thing and stay committed.
What I did, because I want to help every animal, I want to help every person, I can't, I'm just me, but starting the Jane Goodall Institute in 27 countries, Roots and Shoots in 67, That means that the Roots and Shoots can work on saving whales. They can work on, some of the JGIs are fighting illegal animal trafficking. You can do something like this through your podcasts.
Yeah.
You have an audience out there.
Yeah.
You can inspire them. And just people mustn't start thinking about the whole world and getting so bogged down because there's so much to change. Do what you can. And then if millions of people are doing what they can, you see beginning to make a difference.
Would you consider yourself as a spiritual person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would.
What do you believe in?
Well, I was brought up, as you know, congregational. I used to go to church quite often, and then I kind of forgot about that. Then I got into the forest, and there I had this very strong spiritual connection with the natural world, and I felt all around this great spiritual power, which I believe has helped me all through my life. And it was very funny. The other day I was talking to a huge audience in America. I think it was one of 10,000 people. And this woman in the question time said, "What's your next great adventure, Dr. Jane?" And I'd never thought about it. So I did think about it. And I said, "Dying." And there was a kind of dead silence and a few titters, nervous ones, you know. And I said, "Well, look, when you die, there may be nothing. In that case, it's the end. But there might be something. And if there is something, which I believe, then I can't think of a greater adventure than finding out what it is." She came up to me afterwards and she said, "You know, I've always been terrified of dying, but I quite look forward to it now."
Yeah, I also believe that there's that dying is definitely, for me, I don't believe it's the end. I think we go back probably where we come from, and I think it's a good place.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I've got a fear that there might be reincarnation. I really don't want to come back, but I might have to.
Maybe you can choose. Maybe. Who knows? How would you then define spirituality? Because in Germany, and probably it's similar in the UK, some people have this strange feeling about spirituality, that it's dogmatic, or that it's very like only esoteric or whatever, that it's not real. And I think that's sometimes sad because it takes away so much from our life power and from also the connection we have to each other and with nature and with everything. So how would you define spirituality?
I don't think I want to define it, but more and more people are saying that, you know, the fact that people stop believing in any kind of religion. To me, it's, you know, I'm a member of the, what they call it now, but all the faiths, interfaith, and Buddhism and every single great faith, every one of them has the same golden rule: do to others as you would like them to do to you. It's in all of them. And, you know, we now hate Muslims. We hate Muslims because of, you know, jihad and things like that. Like in Britain, we hated Germans because of Hitler. But we have to get away from those fanatical Muslim people, and just think of the ordinary Muslims who are just like us, and the Buddhists, and, you know, having a belief in something larger than yourself and outside, and which is weaving together all life on this planet in a strange way. It's mystical. So I used to describe myself as a mystic.
Mm.
I am. But I think, you know, when religion began to fall out of favor and churches were closed, then these cults sprang up because people want something other than being material. You know, so there were all these weird cults, which were horrible, really, but just people seeking something. So believing there is this great spiritual power, I think, is important. So anyway, that's my belief, and I never push it down anybody's throat because they've got to find it for themselves.
Yeah. Would you say being in nature and going to nature is a way how to maybe connect to that spiritual force?
Yep, I think so. And it's known, it's proven now to be physically and mentally good for our health, for our spiritual and mental health, to be in nature. And some people can't get into real nature, but even just lying on your back and looking up through the branches of a tree, you know, there's a whole other little world up there with insects and leaves. And if you're lucky, there'll be some birds flitting around and life going on, photosynthesis, giving us our oxygen and taking carbon from the air.
Yeah. So one question I ask all of my guests here in the podcast is, imagine one day, I hope it will take still a very long time, there will be the last day of your life. And I would come to you and I would say, Jane, I'm really sorry, but everything got deleted. Your books, your movies, everything you ever did, all podcast interviews, everything is deleted. But I do have a white sheet of paper and a pen. And if everything you ever did wouldn't be there anymore, and you could only write three thoughts or wisdoms you would like humanity to remember and to live by, what would you write down?
Well, first of all, I'd write down, follow your heart, because I think that's important. Second, follow your heart. Remember that you're part of the natural world and you depend on it for everything. So please look after it. And thirdly, do unto others as you would have them do to you.
Thank you. Dr. Jane Goodall, thank you so much for who you are, for everything you do. And I'm just very, very, very honored to have had this conversation with you. So thank you so much.
Which city in Germany are you in?
I'm in Berlin.
Berlin, oh, because I'm coming to Munich in the spring.
Oh, yeah, I will be there.
You're in touch with JGI Germany, are you?
Yes.
Okay, they'll tell you my plan.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'm looking forward to see you there. So thank you so much, really, for everything you do. And I wish you from the bottom of my heart all the best, and that everything you wish for will come that way.
Thanks. And by the way, in Berlin, there is a school called the Jane Goodall School. Did you know that?
No.
Well, you must find it, because it's a school that's open for very poor children, and they're doing roots and shoots, and it's beautiful. I would like to get back to Berlin to visit again, but do try and visit it.
I will. Thank you so much. I definitely will.
Tell you where it is.
Yeah, I will look it up.
Lovely school, and you can give them my love.
I will. Thank you so much. I will definitely do that. And I will really engage my community as well to support all you do and your work, and that a lot of love and support will come your way.
Super.
So thank you so much. Thank you.
Ich hoffe, dass du jetzt gerade genauso bewegt, berührt, Herz geöffnet bist, wie es mir ging nach diesem Gespräch. Und ja, dass es etwas in dir bewirkt hat, dass es dich irgendwie vielleicht auf einer anderen Ebene wachrüttelt und dir nochmal gezeigt hat, wie wir tatsächlich alle mit unserem Einsatz jeder für sich die Welt zu einem etwas besseren Ort machen kann. Und ja, dass jeder so viel bewegen kann. Was ein einzelner Mensch bewegen kann, ist einfach so unglaublich. Also was auch immer deine innere Stimme gerade sagt, was du tun solltest, folge dieser Stimme. Und du findest in den Shownotes alle Links, die gerade für dich irgendwie wichtig sein könnten. Und natürlich wie immer, schau vorbei @LauraMarlinaSeiler lasst uns über diese Folge sprechen. Du findest ja alles da auf Instagram. Bah, ich kann schon wieder nicht mehr reden. Dieses Interview macht mich völlig wirre im Kopf. Also Instagram @LauraMarlinaSeiler. Lass uns da gerne austauschen unter dem Post von heute. Und ansonsten komm so gerne bei mir auf der Webseite vorbei, lauraseiler.com. Du findest da alle Infos zu meinen Büchern, zurück zu mir. Schön, dass es dich gibt. Mögest du glücklich sein. Du findest das Higher Self Home, meinen monatlichen Mitgliederbereich. Ganz viele Kurse von mir, an denen du teilnehmen kannst. Und ja, tob dich da einfach aus. Guck, was für dich gerade richtig sein kann, wie ich dich mit meiner Arbeit auch unterstützen kann. Und alles beginnt in uns selbst. Ja, also wo auch immer du gerade stehst, wo du vielleicht das Gefühl hast, nicht weiterzukommen, fang in dir selbst an und von dort wird's losgehen. Es ist so schön, dass es dich gibt. Danke für all deine Unterstützung, all dein Sein, all deine Liebe und wenn es sich für dich richtig anfühlt, dann teile natürlich dieses Interview so gerne mit allen Menschen, die du kennst. Rock on und Namaste, deine Laura.